What's up, fellow nerds? If you're like me, you've got an application that you're really, really proud of, but unfortunately, sometimes that application can crash. You might get a report from a user explaining that something went wrong, but you might not get an error message, you might not have a stack trace, you're going to have all this information that you're missing that you need in order to recreate the problem in development. Well, if you've got the Sentry client installed, you'll get detailed information about every single crash that occurs. You get a stack trace, a git commit that was checked in, you can get the release of your application, who the user is, and any other context that you need to help recreate the error. You'll get things like a breadcrumb trail, so you can tell exactly what they were doing beforehand, and it'll integrate with your deployment pipeline as well, so it'll catch errors before they even make it into production. The Sentry client has first-party support for many client and server platforms, including a couple of our favorites, Vue.js, Rails, and Elixir. You can head on over to sentry.io and give it a try. They have a free developer account, no credit card required, and it's great for personal projects and applications that are in their early stages. Sentry.io, your code is broken. Let's fix it together. Hey, Sean.
Hello.
Good evening to you.
Yes, good evening. I actually feel like I have some brain power left after today, which is nice. I don't feel totally zapped and used up.
That just means you didn't work hard enough.
I've been delegating. I have contractors now, so I've been delegating and reviewing PRs.
Cracking that whip, the metaphorical Slack whip.
Yeah, well, yeah. So I've been assigning. It's been great. So Drew, the junior developer working with me, I've been able to give him a bunch of tasks that have been kind of maybe called low-hanging fruit. I don't know. But yeah, so it's cool because he's able to do these things. And we haven't had to pair a whole lot on getting him set up and running. So that's been really awesome. So on Tuesday at about 5:30, I just get a pull request with something done. And it's weird. And then on Thursday at about 5:30, I get a pull request with something done. And it's awesome. And so, yeah, I've been merging those. And it's been good. So I've been actually spending a lot of time. And I know last week we mentioned that we wanted to get into some technical talk. And I've been spending a lot of time recently thinking about refactoring and organizing and questioning myself and questioning the code that I've written and just kind of doing that whole feedback loop, I guess.
Being introspective.
Introspective, yeah, maybe. I've been hanging out on the Elixir forums a lot. It's like they're good forums, but I still don't know. If I read too many posts and walk away, be like, yeah, that's a great idea without like thoroughly vetting stuff. But
we've also been reading some books over there too.
Yeah, yeah. So I've been digging into SQL, or no, Database Design for Mere Mortals, it's called.
Is that like the nicer version of Four Dummies?
Maybe. It's pretty good. So I have the queries version. So there's SQL queries from your mortals, Database Design from your mortals. So I have those. I have a SQL cookbook that I got, which I haven't really looked at yet. And then I also got that domain-driven design book. I'll put links to all these in the show notes. But I've been digging more into the database design because I figured it seems like the best place to start learning about design or just kind of sharpening the tool set that I have there. I can make stuff work, but I'd rather feel like I'm an expert in the area than thinking, this should work, you know, and then finding out later that it's not optimal. So anyway, I'm starting with the design book and then going to the queries book and then keeping the cookbook around just to glance at and browse through.
Yeah, that's funny because database design is one of those things where it's like, it's so abstracted away these days that like you don't really have to know how it works. So you have to know just enough to be dangerous. And I think I mentioned this before, but like it took me years to figure out like what database indexes were and why I needed them.
Yeah.
And like I was like, why are all my queries so slow? And then you add an index and it's like constant time and you're, oh yeah, that's a thing. That makes sense. You know, it's a trade-off of insertion and storage time versus lookup time, and you take the trade-off and away you go. That's obviously a simple example, but we're so focused on languages and the frameworks that we forget about to focus on those underlying technologies and all the cool stuff that like databases could just do by themselves, you know, without application support necessarily. I mean, not to get back into the discussion of like, where's my application logic, but
right. Yeah. The whole Hasura.
It's still good to know how that underlying stuff works.
Hasura discussion. I've made a couple of small things that I'd just used for myself just for fun, using PostgreSQL, or maybe it's now it's just called Graphile, I think. Similar to Hasura, where it introspects a database that you give it, and then it builds a GraphQL API around the schema that you have. It's a little bit different than Hasura, because Hasura, you're clicking around in a browser. I mean, you can use a script to migrate a database, but I think to actually build up your schema, you have to actually click around in their UI to add tables and stuff. Whereas Graphile, it's all just done in Node, so you can use whatever Node library you want to use for making your database. But anyway, it just builds a GraphQL API for you. That was fun. But yeah, I feel like you can get pretty far with just using what frameworks kind of give you, like Rails or Ecto. When you generate migrations, it kind of like puts timestamps in there for you. If you use a generator, like when you pass any arguments, say like this field is a string or this field is whatever, it sometimes add indexes for you automatically, which is nice. I think you can get pretty far, but I think especially when I start getting into refactoring or like trying to optimize certain things that I have, I think like the actual knowledge is going to help me out. I think it's going to pay dividends later. And I think really what I'm looking for along the same lines is those code patterns books. They kind of help because they just identify like, oh, here's a recipe for a problem that you can, you know, you can use this recipe to kind of solve that problem. I'm hoping that some like a database design book will do the same thing for me. Like, all right, well, you have to build this thing. Here's a generic recipe that could work for you. You might have to change it, add some ingredients here, change some ingredients there, but here's like a generic way to do it.
Yeah, it makes sense.
Yeah, that's what I'm trying to get out of it. But I think like in general, well, I guess let's take a step back. My routine thing that I've been doing, my morning routine, has been going really well. So I only read tech books in the morning, and I do that for an hour, like right when I wake up, and it seems to, I'm able to focus because I haven't used up all my focus throughout the day, I guess, but it seems to be working well. And then I feel somewhat accomplished already when I get into work and I'm not like restless or anything like that. So it's been working out really well for me. And then, yeah, moving forward. So like I've been working on that book, taking notes, hanging out in Elixir forums, reading more and researching more. And yeah, I don't know. I've kind of been in this little, I don't want to say slump, but I feel kind of like stagnant or stale with the skill set that I have in especially working on DK and refactoring and writing and designing features, I suppose. And you had a couple of things you wanted to talk about last week that I saw in the notes, and it's really funny now because when I looked at them, I was like, dang, these actually line up with what I had to talk about too. So we can get into it, I suppose, but really like that stale feeling, I suppose, when I'm looking around more and like I'm looking at different repos and trying to read code and learn that way, there's so many different, I don't want to say fancy techniques, but reading posts that link to a library in Hex, and then I look at the library and they're like using use all over the place and they have these macros and things, and it's like there's surprisingly small amount of code for what it does. And then I look at Design Collective, and there's a lot of code, and I'm kind of at like an interesting point because I see these enticing features, I suppose, with Elixir, like macros and metaprogramming and stuff. I'm like, wow, I could really dry up a lot of Design Collective's code. But when I start to look at that in practice on Design Collective, what I guess I'm scared of is adding stuff like that, adding more behaviors, adding more interfaces and things, and then having them in there and then going to refactor. I feel like it's going to make that more difficult, because right now refactoring Design Collective is really easy. The code does what it says on the tin. It's like pretty simple. I mean, if you can just follow the trail, like command B yourself through the code, like you can have a really good idea of what's happening, even if it's spread out a little bit. There's no like feeling of magic happening. It's just there. So refactoring becomes changing this thing and then knowing that I didn't accidentally break something else somewhere, because I'm not using a lot of behaviors and stuff like that. So I guess I wanted to hear what your thoughts are, because one of your notes said that you wanted to talk about interfaces and like refactoring them, when to, when not to. So yeah, what do you think about my anxiety about trying to get add some finesse, I suppose, into Zion Collective's code.
So, man, it's tough. So we're thinking on like two a little different levels here. When I was thinking about refactoring of interfaces, I'm talking about maybe like public interfaces into your application, publicly published APIs,
gotcha,
formats of messages, how things are passed back and forth, you know, sort of API versioning, more or less. And at what point do you decide that what I have is too difficult or needs more functionality or is not flexible enough or is too difficult to change, right? And at what point do you basically more or less start fresh, right? I think I mentioned before, I have like a message struct or like a shape of a message, and everything in all our real-time stuff in Urban Ham Radio is based around these messages being passed back and forth. Messages have a bunch of properties. They've got a type. They have an ID. They've got a generic params object, which is just whatever you want it to be, right? Just a hash or an object or, you know, whatever language you're using, a map, right? It's just a key value store. Mm-hmm. And I had this message format, and like I kept having to add to it over time because I didn't design it to be flexible enough from the start. And at what point does that become more of a hindrance than a value to the thing? And like, but it touches every single part of the application. So it's like the, like you said, the overhead of changing all of that at once, because you more or less have to change it at once, or at least have a strategy for migrating over time. It's like, is that worth all of the effort? I think that's obviously, like anything, is going to be a case-by-case basis. It's interesting. So internal to your application, though, you can end up with the same problem, right? Like you have so many... DK is big. Like, it does a lot of different things. And all of the contexts, for lack of a better word, do different things. I don't know... Like, you've done a lot of refactoring in the past where you've taken common elements and sort of made them more generic, right? Like pricing is a big example that comes to mind, right? Like you had different types of discounts and sales and visible pricing and internal pricing and shipping and all this other stuff. And like you condense that down into just more or less one entry point, right? Like you have one way to represent the price for all the products, and you can always add to it later, right? Like that's the perfect example of a very valuable abstraction where everything is the same, but it allows you to, you know, gives you the flexibility to handle that anywhere in your application,
right,
know
yeah.
exactly how it behaves. I don't know your application well enough to know off the top of my head, like, are there other sort of shared components or shared pieces of logic that can be more or less reusable? I mean, the whole thing with object-oriented design is like design for reuse, right? You always start with interfaces and base classes and like common shared code, and then you kind of build off of it. Whereas in functional programming, like we've experienced, it seems more like you start with like a sprawl
yeah.
of like get yeah. it done, and then you kind of find the commonalities and condense it down into behaviors or protocols or whatever.
Yeah, that's a great way to explain it. Because that's essentially, that describes Design Collective's backend pretty well, how it just kind of sprawled out and got larger, and now I'm starting to, like you said, take these different ideas that can kind of be fit into a more generic concept and then moving into that, and it seems to be working really well. And I think what's made some of the refactoring a lot easier for me is that I haven't necessarily tried to over-design for reuse or modularity up front. I just kind of drop the code in there. And that, you know, I'm trying to do the rule where, you know, repeating yourself one, two, maybe even three times is okay. Any times after that, you should probably start thinking about drying things up. So I haven't been really approaching problems with this has to be dry from the start. I've been approaching it with is it easy to follow? Is it easy for me to follow? Will it be easy enough for me to change later? And so far, I'm struggling to figure out or think of a word to explain that. It's not like a simple-minded approach to building an application. It's I'm trying to not over-engineer it up front. Maybe I don't know if that's even the right way to say it. But I guess maybe that's my main fear, is like, okay, I never really felt like I really grasp object-oriented programming. And so I feel like going that way, and to be honest, like a lot of patterns books and things, they're all based off of object-oriented code, right? I even think the Gang of Four book has object-oriented in like the subtitle or something like that. Patterns of reusable elements for object-oriented code. I could be wrong. I'll put it, you know, I'll double check and put it in the show notes, but maybe that's part of it too, is that I've gotten so used to the functional way of building like this, that now I'm starting to look at these more concrete patterns and it feels like it kind of ropes you in, if that makes sense. There's not as much of an escape hatch there. And maybe that's what I'm sort of feeling apprehensive about. But really, what I wanted to be able to do is kind of take down some of that sprawl, I guess, of Design Collective. And the only way really I know to do that is through, like you were saying, kind of abstracting things to be more reusable, be more modular and stuff. And I feel like that's kind of pushing me to a new level, which is always kind of scary. Because again, I never really felt like I grasped, I fully grasped that way of doing things. So yeah, that's where I'm at. I don't know. I started poking around some more books, looking at some books and, you know, design patterns and stuff like that. I ended up going back to my SQL stuff because I think like that's probably going to be having the biggest bang for its buck, because regardless of language or paradigm you use, it's going to go back to the database and you have to have a solid design there. But yeah, I don't know. I was just looking through the forums. So like the other thing I kept coming across or stumbling across in my searches were people posting about doing CRUD apps with Phoenix and Elixir and all that stuff. And people are like, oh, but how fast can you spin up an application? And that always was an interesting question to me, because it's like, is that your aim, is to spin out a bunch of apps really quickly, or what is it? And I guess like in thinking about side projects, things like Rails and Laravel, you can spit out side projects pretty quickly, right? But what happens when it's no longer a side project and maybe it becomes your full-time thing and all that, you know? So you said something to me earlier, which was very interesting. When I was talking about this stuff, you're like, well, your application shouldn't be more generic, because by default, CRUD is like a generic thing, right? Create, read, update, delete. It's pretty generic across all applications. You're like, your app shouldn't be more generic. It should be more specific. And I thought that was very interesting, because when I'm looking at different languages and different frameworks and stuff like that, I'm like, how easy would it be for me to bootstrap an app quickly? And now it's kind of interesting to think like, oh, well, maybe that's not the greatest thing if it's like engineered for me to get stand something up quickly and push it out the door.
Yeah, so you linked me this library called Crudry, CRUDRY. I guess it's a combination of crud and dry.
I didn't even put that together.
That's why I'm here.
Sure.
And it's interesting. It basically is a macro generator. You say Crudry context generate functions and you pass it a schema, and it spits out a crap ton of functions in your module, in your context module. So accounts.getUser, account.getUser with asocs, account.getUser, that was an exclamation.
The bang.
accounts list users, blah, blah, blah. Account search, filter, create, update, delete, right? Like literally CRUD actions to a T.
Sure.
And I'm looking at this, I'm like, what have you accomplished here? You've written a bunch of functions. Hopefully they're overridable, because God forbid you want to, change the behavior of any of these, and the names of the functions are not searchable because they're generated by macros.
Good point.
Right, you can't find where that function is defined or what it looks like. It's way too magical, and it goes totally against what, like, this is just turns context into active record models. Like, it's all this is done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and that's totally the backwards way of thinking. Like, a context should do one specific thing, and how it does it underneath is just totally doesn't matter. It has nothing to do with the schema, has nothing to do with the storage mechanism, has nothing to do with what it takes to get you the answer that you need. It's just a bag of functions. And like, whether your backend is a third-party API or Postgres or a text file or like somebody typing in numbers, like, I don't know, whatever the context spits out, like, it has nothing to do with Ecto. Like, That's what's convenient to work with. It's convenient to return schemas. It's convenient to return change sets with errors so you can, you know, serialize them and display them to user. But like the consumer of that context or the, consumer of the context really shouldn't have any knowledge about that or care about the shape of the data or the structure. Like this stuff, taking something and just wrapping it up just so you can like make a CRUD behavior for some model is like, just go use FileMaker Pro or like, you know what I mean? You've just recreated, access or something. And, there's better tools though. Go use, that cool table, Airtable, like
Airtable,
yeah. Where you wrap in Airtable. I don't know. Yeah. That's how I feel. Fight me.
No, the point that you made was really interesting. You said it becomes active record like at that point. And basically to me, what that means is, when you open up a Ruby model, because it inherits from Active Record Base, it inherits a bunch of stuff with it, a bunch of functions. It's sort of opaque. You can't really, I guess you could like go diving through your editor, you know, like find definition your way through to that. But
well, you're never going to find the methods that are defined by method missing.
Right.
Like all the find by whatevers, you know about those?
Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I mean, that's a really good point because right now in Design Collective, when I go into a context, everything's right there. There's nothing hidden. There's nothing abstracted away. Everything's right there. And I have been chopping down. So there was one really long, I think the context was like 700, 800 lines. It was like one of the first ones. And it kind of overarched. It was just like the main marketplace context. So it had basically CRUD functions and a few other functions for product stores and flash sales. And so I had chopped that into three. And it's interesting because when I think about all the times I've gone back through to change things, I haven't had to jump through a bunch of files and I haven't had to look through a bunch of different definitions because it's in the same file. I think the only thing that's really abstracted out across the entire, like that's reused across the entire code base and all the different contexts is the data context where I'm storing all of my ecto structs, basically my table mappings essentially.
Do you actually have a data module or is it just a namespace?
It's just a namespace.
Okay.
Yeah, just a namespace. So that's an interesting way to think about it. So yeah, I guess I don't know what the pull for me is in thinking about like, oh, I could use a macro and tidy up all this code and push it over here, right? There's always like this pull for me to push this thing over here and then it becomes elegant. It becomes fancier, I don't know, elevated in some way, right? When this whole time I have something that's pretty simple. I mean, you've seen the code base to some extent, like you jumped in and worked on a couple of things and it's not simple, right? It's a big thing. There's lots of stuff that's happening. But in terms of design, it's pretty like on the tin. You open up a module and the functions are in it. And if it's using functions from something else, it's aliased at the top, you know? So I've really tried to fight like import. Like I don't think I'm importing besides tests. I don't think I'm even using import to just transparently import functions into a module. I always use alias, for example. And because of that, it makes find and replace like dead easy for refactoring. But yeah, I guess really like, I don't know where that pull is coming from. I'm looking at these different fancy solutions. And I'm like, oh, that looks great. Maybe I should do something for that with DK. But really, I guess being like the main developer that works on it, the way it's set up, granted, I know the code base, but the way it's set up, it's easy for me to get around and change stuff without worrying about breaking other things. And you know, there's something to be said about having the test suite there and all that stuff, but it's been relatively easy to refactor so far.
So from what you've described, it's you can get in and work around, and it sounds like Dave, was it Dave?
Yeah.
Dave can also get in there and work around, seems like, right?
Hopefully.
so far, so good. So what is it about the code that you're getting itchy or antsy about? Is there something in particular you can point to, or is it just like the need to clean things up? I mean, I don't know. Like, I'm just trying to get at like the meat of the problem here.
Yeah, I mean, part of it's the need to clean things up. There are still some things I want to refactor. So before, like way before when I was first starting to build it, it was still on Phoenix 1.2, which was a pretty different philosophy for designing apps than Phoenix 1.3, because 1.3 came out in introduced context. And so one of the things that I did was instead of using a proper like authorization library. So say something similar to Pundit. So like you have one called Bodyguard, and there's like XPundit is another one for Elixir. So instead of handling authorization role and pulling authorizations into its own sort of, I guess, middleware, you could say, like a layer of your application, I used namespaces because it was just way faster and simpler to kind of achieve the same thing. So for example, if you have products, you have basically publicly accessible information about products, and then you have products that are not publicly accessible. They're limited to a certain, whether it's like an admin or like a, you know, a store owner or something like that. So, and again, we are also doing a server rendered app. And so it made it really easy to sort of do that authorization layer just by the admin controllers call products.manage or marketplace.manage.products, and the non-admin controllers call marketplace.browse.products. And so the context browse.products are purely just get requests for publicly accessible products.
See, I personally love that approach because, well, think about it. Like, again, going back to the Rails world with Active Record, and like the model would do everything, and like the chance that you would call the wrong method on that model and update something you're not permitted to is very high. And but if you don't even have give the user that ability, the code's literally not even there. The code path, there's no path for something in any browse namespace to do any update or anything, right?
Right.
I think that's great. And I think it's a totally legitimate approach as long as you don't have the need for more complex authorization.
So there we go. So we fast forward a little bit, and we end up building out more of the API, and we end up splitting the front end out, and so now it's purely API only, and we can kind of sort of still do the same thing. So with our Nuxt app, we have an admin namespace basically, and so we could update the components on that side to, you know, make sure they only call the admin API endpoints, but it doesn't feel exactly the same because they're strictly not limited to that because it's a client now. It's separated from things. And also when you throw GraphQL into the mix, you're sort of, I mean, with the API and to some extent, again, you know, if we have some sort of authorization plug in front of our REST API, right? So that would obviously check to see if someone's trying to request an admin route and they shouldn't be able to, they're not going to be able to.
Yeah.
But it still felt separate in a sense to me.
Yeah. So I've often wondered about this with GraphQL in particular. Like, they tell you you should only have one GraphQL endpoint on your application.
Mm-hmm.
But what if you had two? What if you had a public facing one and a private one? And the private one, like, you couldn't even browse a schema unless you had a token. That seems reasonable to me. I don't know why I haven't seen anybody doing that, but it seems like you would want a locked down, more or less private API.
Sure, yeah. So I don't know. So maybe that's also part of it, is all this stuff I'm reading, there's nothing else designed like that. It's all kind of designed with one layer, or I mean like one stack with multiple layers, right? So you have your authorization layer, that's where it's done. So because it's done there, your context or your modeling layer, your business logic layer, has no sort of idea of who's requesting the information. It's just giving whatever it's asked of it, right? And so to me, that kind of felt wrong, I guess, because everything else I was reading was like that, and mine wasn't like that. It was different with the browse and the manage context split. So I guess maybe that's sort of where I'm feeling that tension, is because, you know, we have Absinthe, we have a REST API, and we have an authorization layer in there, you know, because we're doing the right thing. We're checking every request, you know, we're not just exposing admin routes without checking the user permissions and stuff. But so I guess maybe where I'm feeling attention is, we have the old style that was really geared towards the server rendered app, and we have the new stuff that's like used with GraphQL, and then we have the stuff in the middle. And so it feels like different eras, maybe is a way to describe it. Like, it's like you're in college now, but then you go over here and now you're like walking through your high school, and there's different memories, different feelings. It's just different, right? It's not the same.
Getting emotionally attached to your code.
It's been 3 years.
That's like a long-term relationship. Like, it's starting to get serious now.
That joke had levels, you know, because that song.
You lost me.
You know that song? It's been 3 years. What is it? Houdini the Blowfish? I don't know. I don't like that song anyway. Yeah, it's been 3 years. It's been a while. So I don't, I guess maybe that's what it is, right? It's like all just different things. I'm looking at things and I'm like, this isn't like what I have. Is what I have wrong? So I don't know. I think your reaction is encouraging, I suppose, but that's where I'm at, trying to fight the, because that's what the advice for macros is, right? Like, hey, don't use them unless you absolutely have to, right? That seems to be the community standard way of approaching them.
I think that's the right way to think. it's like that old joke about XML. It's like, I think I'll solve a problem using XML. And now you have two problems.
So educate me. So why are the main reasons why I shouldn't be reaching towards macros and use and things like that?
There's a lot of ways to all right. Elixir just functions. It's all functions, man. Top to bottom, in and out, just functions. And there's lots of ways to abstract those functions away to get to the right place. I mean, obviously, in object-oriented land, you have methods and you have inheritance. And in Ruby, you even have like mix-ins and stuff. You have all different ways of like modifying the tree of decides what method actually gets called. And in Elixir, by default, it's actually a lot more clear than that. You just kind of modules and you got functions in them, and you just call them directly, and it's fine. And if you have a set of common functions, well, then you have a behavior, and behavior is more, I think, the most analogous to an interface in object-oriented land, where you have a list of definitions of functions, and you just implement them to that interface. And I think that's a pretty, like, I use behaviors very infrequently in my only actual applications. In third-party libraries, they're quite common, because they have to be generic. Things like plug, for example, right? Like, every plug is a behavior. And protocols, I've not even used, like, literally, I mean, I know how they work, I've used them, but never in production. I think that's a really, really specific case where you're implementing, what's the pattern? It's like a traveler pattern or something. I forget the exact name of it, but it's where, like, I don't know, the best example I can think of is, like, walking through a tree. And like each node of the tree implements a protocol, and because it's a struct and it implements a protocol, and you just kind of walk through it using different algorithms based off of how you implement the protocol.
I see. Yeah. Okay.
So, but like, there's almost no problems that you can't solve using protocols using behaviors as well. Like macros, man. So, I like the explicitness in the way Elixir works. Macros are extremely powerful, but they also are magical, and sometimes magical can be difficult, right? We were talking about this cruddery thing. Like, it's literally generating functions whose names you cannot search for because they don't exist until compile time. When you need to use macros, you'll know it, right? If you need to rewrite code, if you need to duplicate code or replicate code, I should say, and you don't want to copy-paste it, like, that's when you should start reaching for macros. Maybe you want to generate a bunch of routes in your router the same way, and you don't want to copy and paste them and change them all. You could use a macro for that. Maybe you want to define a bunch of imports, like the way Phoenix does, right? Like a bunch of imports and use statements, and
sort of have
a common set of tools at your hands, right? That's you could use for the using macro, which every module can implement. The most I dove into macros personally was more or less writing a DSL. Like I've worked on this library. I haven't released it yet. I don't know if I ever will. But it more or less had a sort of configuration format that defined how different things were laid out. And like I wrote my own little thing, that language, so that you can actually specify the configuration for this thing using macros, more or less. And that was really, really cool, and I learned a ton. Like, I read Chris McCord's little book and like had my mind blown several times. But again, that's a very specific case, because that's like you're writing libraries, right? You're writing a tool for someone else to use. I think that's a very legitimate use for a macro, especially if you document the crap out of it. So I mean, I have a hard time finding a use for macros in real world applications. I mean, they're useful for tests, because you want tests to be fast and reusable, and sometimes you need that weird syntax to work out when you're writing like little test helpers,
right?
For, you know, checking pattern matching and stuff. I don't know, man. It's like macros are always an escape hatch, and like they're there because, you know, this was actually really interesting because Elixir 1.9 was just released, and a really interesting thing in the release notes says what's next. As mentioned earlier, releases, which they, you know, they released support for OTP releases. Releases was the last planned feature for Elixir. We don't have any major user-facing features in the works, nor planned. So they're saying that 1.9 is the last feature release of Elixir. Like, period. Like, that, there's sure. No more new things in Elixir ever. Like, that's what they're making it sound like. But you always have macros to add literally whatever you want using the language itself, right?
Right, right. I got you. So I think that example that you gave me where you wanted to basically write code without having to copy and paste it in other places. And then you tied it together with the example of Phoenix, right? So Phoenix has a web module, Design Collective, it's DK Web. And then in that module, there's Def Model, Def Controller, Def View, Def Router. And inside them, it's just using Ecto schema, import Ecto, change that, import Ecto query for the model, right? So basically for every Ecto schema that I have in Design Collective, it uses DK Web model, because then in turn it pulls in Ecto schema, Ecto change sets and queries, right? That to me, it makes so much more sense now, because I would look at macros and be like, oh, that's cool, but why would you reach for that specifically? And the idea of it being a code gen thing makes a lot of sense now, because when I think back to the libraries that I've used that had some sort of DSL like that, it was, now that I think about it, it was always because of CodeGen. It was always because of when you're applying this to your different places, it's going to spit out, or it's going to build functions or whatever with the same look and feel, shape, or whatever. That makes sense now.
So I don't know about you, but I actually... So that web module that gets generated for you by Phoenix,
mm-hmm.
I made a clone of that for just my main application namespace, like the non-web one.
Mm-hmm.
And so I have my own little helpers in there. So instead of controller, view, channel, router, etc., I have context, I have schema, and then I have some other application specific things that I have a lot of, right? And then I just have the same using macro underneath. So then I just, for example, at top of all my context, I have used archar live, comma, context. And then it I get all the stuff I need for context. And for schemas, I get all the stuff I need for schemas and so on. So it's a nice pattern. It's just kind of a clever bit of programming that I haven't seen done anywhere else besides this one file in Phoenix.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'm trying to think of different places where I could apply it. So like one practical example I think of where I want to simplify by doing something are with my various jobs that run. So in Design Collective, I use XQ, which basically just runs things on Redis for me. And so XQ, basically you just have a module with one callback function called perform. And perform receives the arguments that you give the job when you schedule it. So you might say something like xq.q, and then you pass it a module name, you pass it a function name as an atom, and you pass it a list of arguments. So when that job is queued up and is ready to run, so it comes back from Redis, it calls the perform callback. And that's like the only shape, that's the only contract you have to abide by. You have to have a module with a perform function in it. It could be even the same module that queues a job. Doesn't matter. You just need a perform function. And so I've noticed over time, most of the Redis stuff I'm doing happens to do with emails. But over time, like one job might take a contact ID and a store ID. One job might take a string email address and a store ID. One job might take an email subscription ID, which is a GUID, and whatever else, right? So really what I'm seeing is, oh, there's lack of consistency across this, and there could be a behavior to help me enforce this.
Interesting. Yeah, that's a really interesting one, because it's like you said, it's about emails. You need context for who the email's going to, right?
So it was interesting is I like how I arrived at this place was at first we just had contacts and users. And so yeah, that's on me because I didn't simplify anything between them, contact ID or user ID. I could have just passed in a string email address, right? And then we got email subscriptions, which was a newer thing. And so email subscriptions, a contact has an email subscription and a user has an email subscription. So an email subscription is basically a unified email address, and it can belong to a contact. And a contact, so say like three stores have the same email address on their list. Those three contacts will map to the same email subscription, right? And if that person eventually signs up and has a user record, you have four email addresses mapping back to one single email subscription. So that way, if that person says, hey, I want to opt out of all email addresses, period, they will not get any more emails from anyone. Even if a store later on imports that email if on whatever list they have, that person will not receive another email. So now there is a consistent interface that I could rely on. I could always just pass in the email subscription ID and get access to an email that I can say, should this person receive this, period, right? So that didn't used to exist, now it does. Now I have a way that I can refactor to make it consistent. But now I'm thinking about, like, should I make a behavior? How should I actually refactor this to make it consistent beyond knowing in my brain? Because then when I hire someone else, they have to know in their brain too, right?
Well, there's also another piece to this, because you've also been working recently on engagement numbers, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And you could factor that in as well. Like maybe the combination of an email subscription and how engaged that particular user is with previous emails, like maybe that itself is a model. Maybe that's like you have to give it some name, right? Naming is only the second hardest thing in programming.
Sure.
Call it like I don't know, customer is not a good word, but you know, like get make that its own thing. And have it contain everything we need to know about contacting someone, who they are, how active they are, where they live, where do they normally shop, their purchase history, like I don't know, everything that you need to target that user, more or less. It's such a negative term, like you're gonna like
sure
aim a
sure.
sniper rifle at them, but
I'm not inaccurate.
I don't know, maybe that's a valid path you could take is kind of condense all these things down into one data model.
You extended it a little bit more, and now so Mailgun has a template feature now, so you can make a template and upload a template to their server, and then when you're sending an email, well basically you send an API the message, you just tell them this is a template, these are the variables, and they use handlebars to zip them up. And so since I've been converting emails over to that, I have a pretty uniform structure for these modules. So the context, so like marketplace.notifications is the main context for triggering those things. And so essentially each notification has a function that is in charge of who should be getting this thing. So that's where those rules are kind of factored in. So you mentioned engagement levels. I actually have a number of module attributes at the top of all these. So one would be like the template name that should be used. One would be the tags that I want to assign the email when it's sent, so that way I can check engagement across tags, like if I'm A/B testing or if I'm testing changes and stuff. And then the new one is just a list of engagement levels that are eligible for this email. So if the Tuesday weekly email is only eligible to the high engagement list, the only atom in that list is high. And so that way the function that's in charge of get me all email subscriptions except for the ones that have opted out of me and the ones that have opted out of all. And now it says, and the ones that are in, you know, in the eligible engagement level. So anyway, that function is in all of them. There's a function in all of them for building the payload. There's a function in all of them for enqueuing a list of jobs, a function for performing the job. There's that execute callback. So it's pretty uniform across the board. So I feel like I could probably sort of codify that with a little bit with some sort of behavior or something like that. I don't know. But here's the thing. It doesn't feel necessary, I guess. So if I put a behavior in there, right, then I'm thinking like, okay, what about refactoring? What about this? What about that? Yeah, they're pretty close to the same. They're not like the functions names aren't the same across them. It's usually like list eligible recipients or list contacts or it's something similar like that, for example. But, you know, if I'm trying to codify it more, it would definitely make it feel cleaner. Maybe it would make more sense for someone else jumping into the code for the first time. But then again, I'm thinking like, okay, well, that's a moot argument because the second time they look at the code after they look at it the first time, it won't matter, right?
Well, yeah, but then it saves you time in the future when you're like, oh, I need to add a new email type. You already have a contract for that.
Yeah, true. I don't know. So these are like, things I'm thinking about.
Yeah, I mean, that's the whole thing of refactoring, right? It's like the code shouldn't change how it behaves, and that doesn't. Sometimes it feels unproductive because it's like, what's the point? It works now. Why am I changing it? But you mentioned the code feeling stale and needing to be refreshed and updated and more reusable. Like there might be a good path for it. You know, I honestly think if you do that and like take a step back and look at it, you'd be like, yeah, that's pretty cool. Like I feel good about that. I'm actually leveraging features in the language, you know, and you get some safety out of that too. You know, I mean, when you have behaviors, you're not just doing them to like feel good about yourself, right? They provide you with compile time checks. They provide you with a way to document that behavior, right? So I don't know. Yeah. I mean, I don't see any downsides with that. I mean, when you were describing the way the module attributes and stuff work, I could keep going back to this like internal debate of declarative versus imperative programming. So these names are always weird to me, but declarative programming is when you say what you want, and imperative programming is when you say how to get what you want. So in my mind, like declarative programming is like, hey, let's define a bunch of structs up front and then throw them into a function.
Mm-hmm.
And the function just generically handles everything. Whereas imperative programming is more like, hey, let's define a different function for each, handles each use case separately, right? And
right.
Does it more specifically. And I'm always, always battling that with like, it's always this conflict of, do I do this all design work up front? How much time is it going to save? What if it's not flexible enough? Do I just write the function? Like, you know, and that's basically going back to what we were talking about before, but that's all I could think of when you were describing that process.
No, I mean, that's something I think about sometimes too, is right now, I guess a lot of this happens to be affected by me being predominantly the only developer. I mean, Paul was around for a while too, but we were both so busy all the time. I didn't feel like I had time to think about the design up front. Like, yeah, I would think about design, but I wouldn't think about, let me codify this in a behavior or something more structured like that. It was, okay, the design, how this will functionally work feels okay. Let me just start writing functions. And so people ask, like, how are you able to be so productive? It's because I'm just writing functions. I'm not like, I spend some time, again, I'm not just throwing functions in and not thinking about it. I'm trying to just differentiate between thinking about codifying it, using language features, thinking about behaviors and protocols and interfaces and all that stuff versus, yeah, this should work. I can change it easily later. Let's just add the functions. And so it's there and it works. And maybe that's what I'm trying to do, is bridge that gap, because it feels like a working harder, not smarter sometimes. But I don't know. I guess like it's like the truth is somewhere in the middle, right? Because going full out the other way is probably not the right thing to do. And maybe staying where I'm at, where I am, in some fashion, I imagine it will keep limiting things, because like you said, using some of the language features like behaviors, you get those compile time hints. You get things for that. It's just not forcing you into structure for the sake of structure, I guess. So maybe an hour to say, I'm trying to find the right spot. That's what I'm trying to do, is like find the right spot and trying to not be too influenced by the shiny, the books, the posts about wrapping everything up in a macro and like, oh, my application is one use call, you know?
Yeah.
So
don't go too far that direction.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. But no, you're just talking to you about it, I feel like, helps me a lot. Makes me feel better about things.
Aw. You know, something I would just counterpoint, or something I would recommend not doing, and I see a lot of people doing this, and maybe I don't know enough to understand it, but umbrella projects
mm-hmm.
are a thing.
Yeah.
And I've yet to see like an application like ours, like a regular plain old web app that technically benefits from umbrella apps that you can't just accomplish using standard supervision tree in a single application entry point. It's like, it seems like there's so much weirdness surrounding umbrellas, and it feels like an edge case that a lot of things don't account for in terms of configuration, in terms of like Phoenix generators are not happy with umbrellas all the time if you use those. It's like all this extra technical overhead for what? Just for the mental, like, you know, feeling good that you separated these two concerns out. I don't know.
I think
there's plenty of room to do that separation correctly in your application itself. And I mean, I think Phoenix splitting out the application from the web context was like a big win for Phoenix in terms of taking a step in that direction. I wouldn't like consider umbrellas just for the sake of doing it, because I've yet to see understand a real benefit for that besides just the OTP stuff. But it's like you have to really, really know what you're doing, and maybe it doesn't even apply for web apps. So
I think I think my take on that is I think that Jose and crew have worked on some pretty large enterprise applications in their time. And I think a lot of, so that's what you typically hear when you're hearing about Elixir and Erlang, especially Erlang, right? It's great for real-time enterprise applications, enterprise being the keyword, like large, sprawling applications, right? And so I personally feel like a lot of this OTP stuff and a lot of, like one of those things being umbrella apps, that's what that is geared for, is a large enterprise application. And I feel like 99% of the people that are picking up Elixir and Phoenix don't have the same problems that those large enterprise applications have.
Yeah, I think that's totally true. I mean, that's a very nicer way to put it.
Sure. Yeah, yeah. I don't know. It's been a good chat. I feel better about that. It's just me in Slack, so I'm just like yelling into my tech team channel and no one's in there. It's just me. They're getting no answers. Well, I guess Drew and Nick are on there now, and they're there occasionally, and that's cool to have people around. It's been awesome to have people around.
Well, you're working them so hard.
I have so many Notion cards stacked on top of them. No, it's awesome. Drew's like, give me more work.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, it's cool. But so I guess my parting question to you is, knowing where I'm at, is there a piece of literature or place I should go, or something you would recommend me to go and look at that would help? Like you mentioned Chris McCord's, I think it's called Metaprogramming Elixir, right?
I believe that's the title. Yeah.
Yeah. Is there, I don't know. I guess the question is like, is there some place you would point me to having more experience in that area than me? It could be a book, could be articles, could be anything.
Did you ever read Elixir in Action?
One chapter.
Okay. So the further on you get into that book, the further it really dives into a lot of these abstractions. To what value is kind of dubious to me. My eyes started like glazing over at some point.
Okay.
But all that stuff in there, it's Sasha Jurek. I'm not sure how to pronounce that name, but it's really good. Everyone recommends it. And it goes into depth with like real, reasonable examples on how to use some of those things. So I might check that out.
Okay. I think where I kind of get lost on some resources is they start jumping into gen servers and stuff right away, which I have almost no use for in a Design Collective right now. I have no use for them. So I haven't spent a lot of time. I get the basics of it, but when you start like really getting into some hairy, like some real implementation of it, it's hard for me to follow because A, I haven't had to do that. B, I haven't had a need for it. I don't see a need for it coming up that I am aware of. So it's hard for me to kind of break through some of that. And I think maybe that's where, I think the first example in Elixir in Action, if I'm remembering correctly, he's building a game, right? Some sort of battleship or island style game. I don't know. There's a lot of gen server stuff. And I was like, oh man, okay. And then I went to somewhere else. But yeah, I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that because like my... it sounds so dumb, but like I think my best designed Elixir application was probably one of my first, and it was a game actually. I made an online version of Skipbo, which is like it's a card game. It's kind of like a Uno or one of those like game with colored cards, and it was called Skipbot, and it was just an online, you know, it was a Phoenix app where you can join a room and join a bunch of players and play Skipbo, and it was a little React front end where you click the cards and do the whole thing. And but the way I designed the application, the actual game logic was like literally from the ground up. Like I wrote, I made a you know, a card struct, I made a deck struct, and then I wrote all the game logic as just pure functions,
mm-hmm.
right? Like no state management, nothing, just literally here's the function in, here's, you know, user takes a turn, user moves a card here, user puts a card on this pile, like literally just pure functions, no state persistence. Then I wrapped those functions up into a gen server, which then was able to persist a state and you could actually like have a real game, right? But then I had to learn about like registries and you know, how you find processes and manage them and destroy them and keep them alive and supervise them. And then it's like, okay, how do I deal with gen servers and WebSockets and then get that to the front, right? Like there was this whole, like I designed it the most correct way possible because like as a learning experience, and nothing I've done since then has been that good because I'm not that disciplined, right?
Right.
Or maybe it's just the wrong use case or whatever, but like, I don't know, maybe it's just an excuse to maybe find a fun project like that and just like learn about those things, because I, you know, that's how I've always learned, just by doing things.
Yeah.
I would recommend that as well.
Yeah. I should probably do more of that.
You don't have to publish it. You don't have to do anything with it. It'd just be like proof of concept, MVP.
Yeah, it's just been really interesting. This whole time Design Collective has been like, we have to add this thing, I add the thing, and it runs. And in most cases, it doesn't like affect a bunch of other things. It's just kind of chilling, doing what I needed to do until I go back and think like, this is ugly, and change it myself. I've never been forced to refactor something yet, which is nice. And by that, I mean...
Do I still have the repo? I'll just go in and start shaming you for
You're probably an outside contrib at this point. Now that
are
I know...
Are you motivated by shame and me degrading you?
No, I'm not.
Okay.
Well, I don't know. I enjoyed that conversation. I appreciated that
cool.
conversation.
Yeah,
and yeah, if anyone else enjoyed or appreciated that conversation, please let us know. Send Rockwell sandwiches. I think he enjoys pastrami, right? You probably like pastrami sandwiches. I can't tell what that look means.
I mean, pastrami's all right. Dude, I went to a deli, like a legit Italian deli last weekend, and I got like the just an Italian cold cut. I got the small. You can't see it, listeners, but I'm using air quotes because this thing was literally like as big as my head.
Mm.
And the guy in front of me ordered the large, and it was like a baseball bat. It's like you could hurt somebody with it.
I like that.
And they were like cheap too. It's just like I couldn't get over it, how delicious and huge and cheap it was. Just didn't seem fair. Like how are they in business? Anyway,
I was at a coffee shop 2 days ago, and this kid pulled a loaf of bread out of his backpack and proceeded to eat it. It looked like it had olive oil on the inside of it.
Oh man.
A full French loaf of bread.
I was just going to say, it sounded like the most French thing.
Yeah, possible. It was, I mean, it kind of made me hungry when I was looking at it. Yeah. Feedback.
Sandwiches.
We love to hear it. Yeah.
Smash that like button.
Like and subscribe and rate us in iTunes, please. if anyone has any topic ideas, questions, anything really, we'd love to cover it. Love to do some deep dives on some tech. So yeah, just let us know what you're thinking about, and we'll get back to you.
As always, you can reach us on Twitter, DNC Show, for the show account, where you can look for updates about the show. Did I say show? Show.
The show.
Sean is Sean Washbot. As far as we know, he's human. Shrockwell is me on Twitter.
As always, the show notes are available at dnc.show, and I put as much stuff as I could think of us mentioning in this episode in the show notes. So links to books, articles, things like that, code documentation, sometimes GIFs and movies and other things. Yeah, the show notes will be available at dnc.show.
By the way, a little PSA, if you made it this far and you have not listened yet to episode 180, we had to re-upload it because the audio was kind of messed up, so... if you skip that for some reason, it's all fixed now. we'll also post a discussion for episodes over on spectrum.chat. We're over there hanging out. Come say hi. We'll get push notifications in our browser when you do that. So
This is true.
Yeah.
Also, thanks to Spec for having us and putting up with us and just listening to us every week, I suppose, because they have to listen to us too. And if you're interested in other good, even great, some would say, design and development related shows, head on over to spec.fm to see what's going on over there.
It looks like they got a couple listings here from Datadog, previous sponsor of the show, and Reactor.
Yeah, so the job board is listed at spec.fm/jobs. And if you're looking for a new gig, greener pastures, you're seeing what's out there, head on over there to spec.fm/jobs.
This episode of Does Not Compute was edited by Mikhail Delport and produced by Sarah Jackson. And how do we always end up talking about sandwiches at the end here, dude? Now I'm hungry again.
Because it's 7:30 and I haven't eaten yet, so.
Well, I'm approaching midnight snack territory here, so might have to go take care of that.
Just pull the French loaf out of your backpack.
Man, I wasn't prepared.
All right, I'll let you go so you can get that snack.
Have a good weekend, dude.
See ya.
Thanks again to Sentry.io for sponsoring Does Not Compute. Don't wait for your users to report errors to act on it. Iterate on your application faster. Improve customer happiness, and make an overall better product with Sentry's comprehensive error reporting platform. Check them out at sentry.io.